I got to give the credit to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, because I've learned, we have all these cliche sayings, and they're so good, you know, like one day at a time, easy does it, let go, let God, acceptance is the answer, and have gratitude. I think most of the people I know who are leading very positive lives, usually they start their day with a daily gratitude list, you know, whether it's writing it down or running through it in your head. I know for me, I start and end my day with prayer. And gratitude, you know, I say my prayers and then I do my gratitude list. You know, I always do at least 5 or 10 things that I'm grateful for. And I always, you know, I'm grateful for my life. I'm grateful for my sobriety. I'm grateful for the higher power I believe in. I'm grateful for my wife, my kids, my sponsor, my sponsees. And then I'm grateful for all my accomplishments.
This is the Public Health Insight Podcast.
Tim Davis is an educator, mental health advocate, coach, and author of the book titled Tripolar, The Story of a Bipolar Triathlete. In the previous episode featuring part 1 of 2 in our 2-part miniseries on lived experience, Tim shared his story of childhood trauma and grief, substance use, and the mental health challenges he faced following the tragic passing of his father. In this episode, we transition our conversation to focus on his experience with suicidal ideation, his bipolar diagnosis, and how running and triathlons became a crucial part of his path to recovery. Tim also shares some words of encouragement at the end of the episode for others who may be struggling with mental illness, substance use, and addictions. This is where we left off. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, an estimated 4.4% of the U.S. adult population experienced bipolar disorder at some point in their life. And the prevalence of the bipolar disorder, you know, between male and females are pretty similar at about 3%. So I wanted to see if you could speak to a little bit about how, when you first learned that you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and how this kind of shaped the way you would kind of live your life from that point.
Okay. I was age 27 when I was first diagnosed bipolar. And, you know, for 2 years, I'd been trying to figure out how to get sober. And I think I was coming out of my third rehab after another, you know, 3-month relapse. And I was in rehab for 2 months, or not 2 weeks, 2 weeks. But the whole 2 weeks, I was just, I thought I just had insomnia, but I was in a manic episode. I didn't realize it. And I couldn't sleep. You know, I read through all the AA big book and all the stuff they told me to read in rehab and did all the step work. And it's like, because I couldn't sleep, you know, I was highlighting the book, taking notes. I could have wrote my own book then. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of rehab, my wife wasn't ready for me to come back home. And I didn't know where I was going to stay because I, you know, prior to that, checking into rehab, I was living out of my car for the last 3 months because I was kicked out of the house. And her parents decided they'd put me up, but I went there and I still couldn't sleep. And I just, you know, made this decision. I'm like, you know what? I can't get sober. I don't know how to live life sober. I don't know how to live life not sober. And I, at that time, I decided the world would be better off without me. So I proceeded to start, you know, journaling, which ended up turning into like a 6-page suicide letter with basically the F word was every other word. And like the long and short of it was the world would be better off without me. And then I finished that letter. I left that note in the room and I called my wife and my mom and said, told them that. And my plan was to go jump in front of a train. But then I drove to the train tracks and then I, you know, was walking along and I was like, you know, I don't think jumping in front of a train would feel very good. And luckily, my wife and my mom had called the authorities and they came and swooped me up. And I got put into a suicide tank for a week on a 5150. And it was after that I saw the psychiatrist there at the hospital in Pasadena. And that's when I got diagnosed bipolar. Was after, I guess you could call it a suicide attempt. I mean, I didn't jump in front of the train. I did walk alongside the tracks, but I didn't actually walk on the tracks. But I certainly had suicidal ideation. And then I was in rehab again, a dual diagnosis unit this time. And I do remember when they told me I was bipolar, I was angry. I did not want to believe that I had one more thing wrong with me. You know, I was already I couldn't figure out how to stay sober from alcoholism and addiction. And now I've got this double whammy. And it took me a couple years to really accept that diagnosis and stick to the treatment plan and become med compliant. Because some of the meds they tried on me gave me the shakes. Some of the meds they gave me increased my appetite too much and caused too much weight gain. And it took a while for them, you know. And that's the thing when you get diagnosed with bipolar is different meds work with different people different ways. We all have different biochemistry. So you, and that's my advice to anybody when you first get diagnosed is be patient with your doctors. You know, some meds are going to not work and work for different people. So you just got to try it for a little while. And if it's not working, you got to let your psychiatrist know. And but stick with it, you know, and strongly advise take the meds they tell you to give. Because every time I went off my meds, I relapsed. You know, I just started self-medicating with drugs and alcohol again.
Yeah, and communicate with your doctor if you have any side effects. That's important too.
Very important.
It seems like, you know, your bipolar diagnosis was such an integral part of your recovery. But for so many people, and men especially, talking about mental health is stigmatized. And, you know, we know that on average, one man dies by suicide every minute. And, you know, the rate of male suicide is about 6 out of 10 suicides occur in men. And so I find it so, like, both striking, but also, you know, this it can be empowering for others because it shows that having that diagnosis helped push you that extra step to get to where you are now in recovery. And so, you know, although it could be scary and definitely there is still a lot of stigma, it's important to talk about.
Yeah. But the other thing that actually was a positive thing for me was I was working for Los Angeles Unified School District at the time, and they have very good health benefits. And once I had the dual diagnosis with the, you know, the bipolar disorder, not just the alcohol addiction, I got qualified for a lot more treatment. So I was able to get a lot more treatment and stay longer in the hospital so I could, you know, try and get well and see the psychiatrist more. So that was a good benefit. And, but on another note, I was still so ashamed of my bipolar that I only told like my direct family and a few close friends. And I really kind of, you know, kept it anonymous for everybody else that was in my life. Because I kind of was ashamed of it for a long time. I just didn't like to talk about it for many years.
Just a personal question to pose to you. It sounds like being diagnosed with an, you know, alcohol addiction was a seminal moment in your life. And then bipolar. Is there, which of the two do you think kind of, I know you mentioned that bipolar, being diagnosed with bipolar made you angry because it was a second thing added on to the alcohol addiction. But was there, if you had to say one of the two, which one was the harder pill to swallow? Was it the first one? Or it sounds like bipolar, you kind of took matters in your own hand. And, you know, you mentioned having benefits through your employer and you were able to seek help. So I don't know if you could speak to, those two defining moments of your life, maybe compare and contrast how it affected you.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very good question. Thanks for asking that. I would say with the alcoholism and the addiction, I kind of always knew that the way I drink and used was not right. And, you know, I tried various ways of my own methods to try and either cut back or kind of control and enjoy my drinking and using it. And I continued to fail after time. But I always knew that the way I drank and used was not right. And that I should either somehow figure out how to cut back, which was my hope was that I could learn how to moderate. But I knew I needed to quit. And then with the bipolar, it was a much harder pill to swallow because I didn't know much about mental health. And I was very angry when I got first diagnosed. I did not want to believe it. So that was definitely the harder one to accept for me.
Right. And it's almost like you, from reading the book too, it's like you almost felt that at any time, you know, whether it was true or false, that you could control the alcohol part if you wanted to. And now you get diagnosed with bipolar. It's like, it's not something you can control.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It seems like, you know, that was, you know, things were becoming increasingly more out of your control with that diagnosis.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And that was awesome. Very hard.
So thanks for sharing your story. We touched on kind of all those experiences that brought you to where you are now. And, you know, those experiences define who you are today. But I wanted to touch on chapter 18 when you start talking about your triathlons, which you're very passionate about. So in adults aged 18 to 64, we know that physical activity includes leisure time, physical activities such as walking, dancing, gardening, hiking, you name it. And the World Health Organization recommends that We should be getting at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic physical activity throughout the week. And, you know, you have people like you, Tim, who, you know, triathlon's not on the list, but somehow you're in the world of competing and participating in these triathlons. So how do we get from your earliest experiences with your, you know, father tragically dying to participating in triathlons?
Wow. To go from my father dying to your triathlons, that was a long journey. I went through high school playing football, basketball, and running track. And I enjoyed running track. I ran the 1 mile and 2 mile, and I was a distance runner. And then in college, when I was trying to control and enjoy my drinking, I started running the marathon every year. I ran the LA Marathon for 3 years, freshman, sophomore, junior year. My senior year, I was drinking and partying too much to train and commit to it. And then after college, you know, for a couple of years, I got out of, you know, doing that. And then we had kids. And when I first got sober at age 25, 26, I did a couple of sprint and Olympic distance triathlons while I was, you know, in some periods of sobriety. But then I had a second kid and just, you know, my disease, I got into some dark years for a few more years. And then when I finally got sober, I got sober in 2004, and I stayed sober for 3 years and 2 months. And during that time, I started running a few half marathons, ran a couple marathons, but I was really overweight. I was probably around 230 for most of that period. And so I was running much slower. And then I had that last relapse in March 2007. And my sobriety date, I should say, is June 15, 2007. I've been sober since then. So I got 13 years and a couple years sober. And in my first year of sobriety, like when I gained about 60 pounds, and by the time I was a year and a half sober, I was up to 250 pounds and I was depressed. Yeah, I remember it was December 31st, 2008. It was the New Year's Eve before 2009. Stepped on the scale and said 250. And I just had this thought, wow, at 250 rounds up. You know, I was a math and science teacher. Mm-hmm. And like 250 rounds up to 300. I'm like, at this rate, I'm going to end up on that show, The Biggest Loser or something. And that'll be the only way I can lose weight. So I basically, in my head, I said, screw that, you know? And I'm like, starting tomorrow, I'm going to stop eating seconds. I'm going to start going to the gym every day. And I'm not allowed to watch TV or play video games unless I've exercised for at least an hour. And that was just the three simple things I did. So and then on January 1st, 2009, first thing I did was went to the gym, got on the treadmill. I'm like, let's see how fast I can run a mile right now. And I had also been chain smoking a pack of cigarettes a day up until that point. And it took me 12 minutes to run a mile. And I was like, man, this really sucks, you know, because in high school, I could run a sub. In high school, I ran a sub 5 minute mile, you know, and I'm like, wow, 7 minutes, you know. And so that was my goal. It's like, you know what? I'm just going to keep running a mile every day. And eventually, you know, the weight will come off and I'll be able to get faster again. And then I started running 2 and 3 miles a day and just slowly progressed. And on 6 months later, I was running a half marathon again and I was back down to 6 minute miles. You know, I was already 35 years old, so I wasn't worried about trying to run a sub 5 minute mile again. But I did get down, you know, in 6 months, I lost 60 pounds. And then I had this weird injury. I had this hip protrusion. I don't know. I went to see a couple different specialists. Nobody could quite diagnose it. But basically, in my right hip, it just felt like there was, I don't know, like a giant railroad spike in it. Every time I tried to run, like it just hurt really bad. And I couldn't get an accurate diagnosis until one doctor finally said, you know, what we think happened is you just lost so much weight so fast that your body's kind of out of whack. Right. And it's just trying to realign itself. So for like 2 or 3 months, I couldn't run, but I could swim and bike. So I just started cross training and I was like swimming and biking every day. And then my body kind of recalibrated and I could start running again. And I was like, hey, I should try a triathlon again, you know, because it had been several years since 2000 when I'd done one. It was 2009. And I went out and did this Hanson Dam triathlon here in LA County. And, you know, I went out there with a mountain bike and basketball shorts and this old beat up helmet. And I wasn't really, you know, looking like all these triathlon guys. But, you know, like, I'm just going to go out there and do it. You know, I ended up getting 16th in my age division, which I thought was amazing for somebody who was just planning to finish. And I was like, wow, you know, if I actually, you know, kind of, you know, really train and get some of the better gear that these guys got, you know, the aero helmet and a real carbon fiber Cervelo bike and some other things, I could do this much faster. You know, I never became a professional, but I did finish, you know, in top three in my age group in some races. And I really just caught the bug, as they say, and started trying to do every triathlon I could find. And then I started doing longer and longer ones. You know, a couple months later, I was doing my first half Ironman. I did my first half Ironman October 2009. And then I was like, wow, you know, I felt great after doing a half Ironman. I'm like, if I can do a half Ironman and I feel this good, I could probably do an Ironman. And, you know, 10 months later, I was doing my first Ironman. And after I did that one, I was like, wow, you know, I was a little sore and tired after that, but I felt good. And I'm like, wow, if I can do my first, you know, I did it in 12 hours and 42 minutes. I'm like, maybe I can do it faster, you know, and that just became the thing. Is, you know, and for several years, I did two Ironmans a year and I kept chasing faster times and personal records. And and then I started ultra running.
Yeah. Wow. It's great to hear about your passion for, you know, triathlons and marathons. And, you know, all these accomplishments. How did running contribute to kind of your, you know, controlling or, you know, maintaining physical and mental well-being during all that was going on?
Well, basically, it saved my life. Because, you know, for me, being an alcoholic and addict with bipolar disorder, you know, they say we have a disease of a threefold nature, you know, it's physical, mental, and spiritual. And I could take care of, you know, the mental part by staying med compliant. I could take care of the spiritual part by going to my 12-step meetings and sponsoring guys and being sponsored and doing my step work. But the physical part, you know, you're getting the benefits from the runner's high. Like sometimes, you know, I was feeling antsy because I'm a type 2 bipolar rapid cycler, you know, so I have highs and lows throughout the course of the day. And I get kind of hypomanic all the time. I just have this energy I need to burn off. And, you know, I can't always get to a meeting, but I can always put on my running shoes. You know, if I got a half hour, I can go out and crank 3 or 5 miles during my lunch break or whenever. And so it just, it's been a lifesaver when I can't get to 12-step meetings or to, you know, anything, any other kind of stress outlet. I just have always turned to, you know, running, biking, or swimming. And yeah, it's been a lifesaver. I don't know what wife can tell if I haven't exercised in a day or two. She's like, you're getting really cranky. Wow. You need to go for a run.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite lines when you talk about your triathlons is, I became tripolar to treat my bipolar. Can you explain a bit about what that means and what that means to you?
I just, because I have bipolar disorder and I am a triathlete, I just like the term tripolar. For me, tripolar was, you know, taking care of the mind, body, and spirit, you know, like I said, the disease of a threefold nature. So there's the trinity of working on those three things to kind of become a holistic person. And in triathlon, you know, you swim, you bike, you run. So there's the trinity of those three disciplines, you know, to complete one type of race. And so that's why I like the word tripolar, because I'm a bipolar triathlete. So yeah, and it just, once I found triathlons, I really felt steady in my recovery. It was like this one more thing that I needed to do for self-care so that I can really feel stable and, you know, lead a balanced life and a successful life, because I've had many successes now and sobriety and in recovery since I found, you know, exercising in any form really to manage my bipolar also.
It's interesting to me how running has been just a common thread in your life from, you know, even prior to, yeah, before having your bipolar diagnosis, before where you are in recovery now. And so what I noticed is that it seemed earlier on you were running from experiences, running from difficult emotions. But now I'm curious, what is your motivation? Do you feel that you're still running from something, or is it more so running towards, like towards a goal, for example?
Ooh, wow, you know, it really depends on the day and my mood. Generally, I'm running towards goals because when I train, if I don't have a race that I'm training for, I don't know what the point is to get out, put on my running shoes. So I've always have a busy race schedule. I finish one race and I'm already thinking about the next race. But I still, when I have painful things happen, like my brother died from alcoholism 2 years ago at age 32. Oh.
Sorry to hear that.
So sorry.
Yeah. And when he died, I couldn't get to a meeting, but I could go run. And the first chance I got, I love mountain running, trail running. I'm an ultra runner, and we have beautiful, you know, Angeles National Forest and Gilbert Mountains. I took off running and I did like 31 miles, and all I brought was water. Normally I bring like several Cliff Bars, and I just didn't even pack food, and I just ran and ran and ran. And I just felt so good to just get a long run in, you know, that took several hours. And it's just, you know, so it's like there's this group out here called Riot, which stands for running as our therapy. And, you know, sometimes
I love that.
Yeah. Sometimes when life's problems get me down, be it, you know, stress at work or, you know, a different, you know, issue with, you know, one of my three kids, because raising kids can be stressful, as we all know. you know, I can go out for a run, and it doesn't have to be a 30-mile run. It could be a 3 or 5 mile run, a short run. And, you know, I can't think of the problem or solution right there when I'm at home and I'm stressed out about it, but I can go out and run and I can kind of clear my head and I feel kind of like I hit this meditative state and then I find the solution. And sometimes the solution is just have acceptance, you know, or just be loving and tolerant, you know, don't, you know, it's just a lot of times I can go run and clear my head and figure out solutions to my problems, you know, so.
That's powerful.
Yeah. You know, and that brings me to what you said in chapter 25, you said something like, you know that your running days are numbered and that your ultra running career has an expiration date.
Yeah.
And you said, but I'm glad that I found my tripolar way to deal with that too. So what are some other ways, coping strategies that you're going to adopt when you're not able to be as active of a runner one day?
Well, I've recently started kayaking, and I figured, you know, I can do elliptical and spin classes, and you know, when it comes to it, I'll find even more low impact sports like aqua aerobics or whatever, because I go to the gym, and, well, when the gyms were open, I go to the gym, and some of my friends are in there, because I have a lot of older friends that are in there doing the aqua aerobics, and I'm just like, that's going to be me one day when my body can't tolerate so much of the heavy pounding that running, you know, entails. And that's fine, you know, and I figure I'll take up other hobbies. Maybe I'll write another book. I've started meditating more recently with another 12-step fellowship I'm going to. They highly recommend meditation. So I like sitting still for 5 or 10 minutes a day. You know, meditation is a practice and I have a hard time sitting still. But if I can fit to 10 minutes, as this program suggests, I'm doing pretty good. I know some people do it for hours. You know, I don't know how they do it, but maybe I'll get there one day.
Just on hearing other ways that you're finding to help stay or to help maintain your recovery, I wonder what you would say to someone who perhaps wants to try to implement something new. Maybe they want to get into exercise, want to get into running or another activity that you've mentioned, but they're just struggling with that first hurdle of just beginning. What could you say to kind of speak into that and how to perhaps encourage somebody who could benefit?
All right. Well, in the words of Bill Murray from the movie What About Bob, I would strongly suggest baby steps. If you guys haven't seen that movie, you should check it out. It's really funny with Bill Murray and Richard Dreyfuss. Richard Dreyfuss is the therapist and Bill Murray is kind of the patient, but it ends up having a role reversal. But yeah, baby steps. Sorry, I digressed there. And just start small, you know, like when I, in 2009, I just said, I'm just going to run a mile a day until I feel like I can run more, you know, and I wasn't even running a mile. I was like walking, half running, you know, I couldn't run a straight mile. I had to walk a lot. So even if it's just, you know, walking around your block or whatever the sport you choose is, just commit to starting out 5 or 10 minutes, and even just doing a few minutes is better than doing no minutes. So start out doing what you can do and just build up from there, you know, and, you know, every few weeks, add a few more minutes or a few more miles or whatever it is, you know, and then you can progress until you find, you know, your happy medium. I mean, or whatever your goal is for the distance or time you want to put into whatever sport it might be or activity it is.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I feel like, you know, if you set your goal as I'm going to try to do 10 minutes of running, and if you fall short of that, then there's no point. What you're saying is just set baby steps and improve based on your kind of baseline that you've set. So that's a good way. That's a good way to approach it. So I know throughout this episode, we kind of touched on some of your experiences that have, you know, made you into the man that you are today. But I want to give you an opportunity for final words to any words of enlightenment, positivity. We don't want it all to be about the bad things that have happened, but, you know, you can share some of the good things going on in your life, any positive messages for our listeners, and anywhere else you want to take it. Floor is yours.
The floor is mine. Wow. There's so many things I can say, but more than anything, I got to give the credit to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, because I've learned, we have all these cliche sayings, and they're so good, you know, like one day at a time, easy does it, let go, let God, acceptance is the answer, and have gratitude. I think most of the people I know who are leading very positive lives, usually they start their day with a daily gratitude list, you know, whether it's writing it down or running through it in your head. I know for me, I start and end my day with prayer and gratitude. You know, I say my prayers and then I do my gratitude list. You know, I always do at least 5 or 10 things that I'm grateful for. And I always, you know, I'm grateful for my life. I'm grateful for my sobriety. I'm grateful for the higher power I believe in. I'm grateful for my wife, my kids, my sponsor, my sponsees. And then I'm grateful for all my accomplishments, you know, like all the races I've been able to do, getting my master's degree, writing this book, and just having a nice home and a car, because there were periods of my life where I didn't even have a car. So just all the, you know, the material luxuries are nice too. So just grateful for all these things, and you know, the friends I've made along the way. Like when I got sober, you know, I had to ditch all my old friends. There's a saying in AA, if you hang around the barbershop long enough, eventually you're going to get a haircut. So I just couldn't hang around with my friends who were still drinking or using, or I was going to end up taking a drink or a drug with them. But I've made so many amazing friends in AA and NA. The people that get sober, just, you know, they start working the steps, it changes your life. It's just, I love all my new friends. And a lot of them, several of them are also runners and triathletes. So we train together too. And we kind of have the saying, you know, in the AA rooms, they say, what's said in the meeting stays in the meeting. And we also, when we're out there training on the trails, we're like, what's said on the trails stay on the trails. And a lot of times me and my running buddies, we go out there, like my friend Larry, he was going through a rough divorce and we went through several runs together. And he just talked about it, you know, get it off his chest. And it's like free therapy out there, you know. Just that's the other thing they say, an AA meeting or an NA meeting is just anywhere where it's two or more gathered, you know, one alcoholic or addict talking to another, you know, about trying to make positive change and, you know, stay sober and focus on recovery and positive outcomes, you know. So that's what I would say from my experience.
awesome. And I guess more explicitly, you could just share a little bit about your book that you wrote, and the book that this whole episode is based on. So just to give you an opportunity to touch on that as well.
Yeah. God, there's so many things I could say about this book. First and foremost, when I first wrote the first draft, it was an autobiography. And then I learned that nobody wants to read an autobiography from somebody who's not famous. So then I learned how to convert it into a memoir after several drafts. I want to acknowledge my wife, who really helped me fine-tune the final draft and turn it into a reader-friendly page-turner kind of a book, because you guys have read the book and I think it flows pretty well. And you know, I feel like it's something when you, if you read the first chapter, which does start off with the tragic event of my dad's death, you know, it kind of, I feel like it makes you want to learn more about what happens to this guy. And ultimately, you know, it's a hero story, you know, and it's divided into three parts, you know, the first part being, you know, childhood trauma and delving into addiction and alcoholism. And the second part being, you know, being diagnosed with bipolar and learning how to get sober. And then the last part, which is my favorite part, is talking about a lot of the races I've done, the Ironmans and the 100-mile runs and, you know, the other successes I've had in sobriety and recovery. And I think everybody likes a good, you know, redemption story or hero story, comeback story, if you will, because a lot of people go through hard times and they like to, I think we all like happy endings, right?
And just share the title of the book as well.
Oh yeah, the book is called Tripolar, The Story of a Bipolar Triathlete, and it's available on Amazon, Apple Books, by Barnes & Noble, several other outlets, Book Depository, Indie Books, and it's available in ebook, paperback, and audiobook.
Definitely, we'll plug a link in our description for these episodes as well.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yep, so thank you, Ultra Tim, for sharing your intimate experiences with us on this podcast, and I'm sure our audience will appreciate everything you've said today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope I can inspire some others, because that was my ultimate goal for the book, was to inspire others who might be struggling with any of these issues, to let them know, you know, if you change some things, is possible, and, you know, you can have positive things going on in your life. So I just hope I inspire others who might be struggling to get to the other side of it too. You know, I was diagnosed at age 27, but it wasn't until I wrote this book this last year, you know, at age 46, that I realized that I'm making myself vulnerable to the whole world and sharing about it. Like I did mention, I did mention that I only told my direct family and a few close friends, but I wish I would have mentioned that it took me 19 years to really like be comfortable talking to it about, you know, to the whole world about it.
You know? Awesome.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our content and would like to stay up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. To learn more about our community initiatives and how you can support us, visit our website at thepublichealthinsight.com. Join the PHI community and let's make public health viral.